Hello there and welcome to ArtVox. I'm Rebecca Wilson. This is a series of podcasts where I talk to creative people from Australia and overseas. Recently, the Mudgee Readers Festival had to be cancelled, which meant that I wasn't able to meet or listen to the writers I'd been so looking forward to seeing at the festival. In an effort to mark the occasion, some of those authors have generously agreed to do a podcast with me, and I'm so glad to get the chance to have a chat with them. Today I'm speaking with the fabulous Nikki Gemmell. She's a best-selling author. She's published more than 20 books in both fiction and non-fiction. She was living in London for many years but has now returned to Australia. Her distinctive writing has gained critical acclaim in many places, but the French literary magazine Lire has included her in a list of what it called the 50 most important writers in the world, those it believes will have a significant influence on the literature of the 21st century. In April this year, Nikki released the fictional work The Ripping Tree, and at the end of July, her non-fiction work Dissolve was released. I had the absolute joy of reading Dissolve before I spoke to Nikki, which was also an absolute joy. This book is great, and I think it's more than great. It's important, and it really resonated with me as a woman in her 40s in the creative industries, and I think it's going to resonate with a lot of women, even if you're not in the creative industries. It is just clever, powerful, and beautiful. And so here is my chat with Nikki Gemmell.
Welcome, Nikki, and thank you very much for having a chat with me today.
Oh, thank you. What a delight to be here.
Thank you. So you've carved out a hugely successful career for yourself through what seems to me as a life of dedication to your craft and finding your way to stick to your craft, you know. Writing is clearly a huge and important part of your life. In your book, After, you describe writing as your ballast through life's toss. You write for The Australian and you've published extensively in both fiction and non-fiction. How would you describe your love of writing and what it brings to your life?
Look, writing anchors me. It calms me. It makes me feel normal and the woman who I really want to be. If I'm not writing, I get really, really frustrated and agitated. It's like I almost step outside of myself if I can't do it. And the people that impacts on the most around me are my kids. You know, if I'm not doing what I really want to do in life, I get very, very frustrated and kind of shouty. I turn into that mother that I never wanted to be, that woman that I never wanted to be. So when I can write, it just kind of settles me and recalibrates me. So that's why I do it. And I kind of fight to do it, not in an aggressive way, but just as I make my way through life, I just very firmly carve out space for my own creativity and my writing to keep me going, basically.
Yeah. So a lot of people who don't live a creative life probably don't necessarily fathom the challenges of running your normal life and then having time for your passion that actually is integral to who you are, that impacts your life if you don't get to do it. I guess for me, I always think, you know, being an artist, I have so many art friends who don't make money out of their art, or hardly enough to, you know, you couldn't make a living of it. So holding down a part-time job, giving yourself enough time to paint and, you know, and write or whatever it is. So always juggling all the aspects to make that space, carving out space. Is that what you're talking about when you're referring to carving out space?
Yes, absolutely. My life is very demarcated. I mean, COVID's kind of thrown it out the window because at the moment you might have heard some thuds a couple of minutes ago. My uni student son getting out of bed at, 11 o'clock in the morning. I'm stuck in the room next door. And then I've got a high school student and a primary school student under my feet. at home plus a working from home partner. So we're very crowded and my head's really scatty at the moment. But usually in my regular life, I'm very, very disciplined about carving out that space. And for me, that's the 6 hours when the kids are at school. So basically they go to school, you know, they're gone, they're out of my hair by 9 a.m. and then I'm starting to think about them again at 3 p.m. Those precious 6 hours that I've got in a house on my own, which feels like it's been so long since I've had that. But, you know, I'm very, very disciplined about jumping on the laptop and doing what I love doing more than anything. And, you know, the sink might be exploding, the dirty clothes, you know, we wash every day here because there's so many of us. But, you know, all of that, I try and do that when they're all underfoot and around me, so that I basically have a clear, clean space to create every day when I can. But saying that, because I've wanted to keep my career going through 4 kids, you know, I take my laptop everywhere. I find places to work all over the place. So on holidays, I've got my laptop with me. You know, just in my day-to-day living, whenever I'm out and about, I'll usually have a notebook or a laptop with me. So I guess it's different to a visual artist that perhaps, you know, they need their studio to work, but it's like carrying a notebook with you and jotting down sketches or something all the time. I'm constantly jotting down little notes to just fold through my work whenever I can.
In previous interviews, you've said that you see your works as political, that you often write to disturb or unsettle, and that it's important to you not to flinch away from truths. What does it take for you to persevere when you're building a work and you find yourself questioning, am I going too far? What is the driving force for that commitment?
Look, I so often think, oh, my God, am I really writing this? You know, it's just too close to the bone. It's too excruciatingly honest. It's embarrassing. Oh, my God, can I really be saying it? But I do know that honesty connects. That there's such a powerful force to honesty. I think particularly female honesty, because we're so conditioned to presenting a version of ourselves to the world that mightn't be perhaps our true self or our authentic self. So I think when a woman actually speaks very honestly and bluntly the truth, it can be enormously connecting and liberating for others to hear that and instructive. You know, sometimes when I'm writing, I think, just imagine like Elena Ferrante, that you were able to, your name was able to disappear from this. I've tried that in the past. I've tried writing anonymously. It's incredibly freeing as an artist. Virginia Woolf said that anonymity is a woman's refuge. And for me, that is so true. It's like a harbour to rest in away from the toss of the world. It's a place where you can feel so strongly yourself. And for me, I think there's great power in questioning writing. You know, so much of my work, it begins with a question or a doubt. I'm trying to find something out, or I'm trying to work my way through something, and I might even get to the answer. I might never find out the answer to the question, but I've gone on a journey to get there, and usually it's a very, very honest journey. And it's really my readers responding to that honesty that keep me going. It's people saying, you know, Nikki, I thought I was the only one who felt like that, who thought those things. I felt so alone with how I felt, but you know, reading you, it makes me think I'm not alone. And I guess for me, you know, over the years, I've read so many wonderful female writers, like deeply honest female writers, you know, Catherine Mansfield, Colette, Sylvia Plath, Charmian Clift, Doris Lessing, Elena Ferrante. And it's their kind of unflinching honesty that has been my tuning fork in a way as I go on with my writing life.
So in Dissolve, you have these beautiful references to other female writers and artists and their lives. And they slip so beautifully into the narrative of the work. And I was wondering, with the selections of the writing that you chose to insert into the book, were they already floating around in your mind, or did you seek those out to insert things that were relevant at the time? I was really interested in how that sort of collage came together.
Well, I basically, as I write, I've got this little wooden old sandwich box next to me, and it's full of all those writers, you know, Colette and Charmian Clift and Janet Frame and Plath and Anne Sexton and, you know, all these writers. I've had their words in my head for decades, and as I was writing the book, I was going back to my own journals. I've carried a journal since I was journals with me since I was 14 years old, and my year 8 English teacher basically handed them out in class one day and said, right, girls, I want you to fill these up. I'm going to collect them every Friday. I'm not going to look at what you've written. I just need to know that you've written something. And so basically from, you know, when I was 14, I've been writing in a journal, and that is scraps of quotes, conversation scraps, observations of, it might be someone on the bus, might be a conversation I'm listening to, you know, as I'm sitting behind them on the bus, or it might be, you know, a traumatic breakup, whatever. So when I was writing Dissolve, I was able to go back to my journals, to that moment in time when I lost my virginity in, you know, first year university, that moment when I was 16 and was on a film set and a guy used to knock on my door late at night, to that moment in my mid-20s when my heart was broken because I was jilted, you know, before I got married. And all around those instances in my journals were quotes from these women, you know, that I had written at the time, and they spoke to me at the time, these strong, honest, blunt, sparky women. So I was able to get those quotes from something I'd written 25, 30 years ago, and, of course, had to check, you know, the veracity of it and that I'd got all the commas right and all the rest of it. But I guess also, you know, I was looking at these women's lives through a particular lens with the writing of Dissolve. It was, for the first time ever, really looking at these women as creative people in a creative partnership. So the female ego coming up against the male ego. So, for instance, with someone like Sylvia Plath, for the first time with Dissolve, I read Ted Hughes' autobiography, which was fascinating and gave me a wealth of material, you know, stuff from his perspective or from Asya Weevil's perspective, which gave me, you know, a feel for what it must have been like for Sylvia to have lived with Ted in a very creative partnership, but her creativity was subsumed by the male ego. So that was how I was looking at all these women now as I was writing Dissolve, not specifically the breadth of their whole lives, but what it was like to exist within a creative partnership.
It was very striking to me, all of these beautiful analogies when you're looking at these artistic relationships. And you were talking about issues that, you know, conversations I've had with other artists, you know, about the dynamics of relationships when you are a creative person. And so when you have the two creatives in a relationship, it's potentially volatile and, like, you're competing for oxygen. So it's really interesting then to see how detrimental it consistently has been for the women in those relationships.
Yes.
What do you think about that? Like, what is going on there? Why is it so consistently this way, do you think?
Look, I was fascinated by how many of these muscular women in terms of creativity were dissolved when it came to being confronted by the male ego. And I think for so many women, not all women, I'm talking about heteronormative women, you know, love, our Achilles heel. Love will dissolve us. I look at my own daughter and you know, strong, sparky, stubborn young women around me with big open hearts, and I think they blaze with power and they're going to take on the world and they're going to win the world. But the one thing that will fell them, that will dissolve them, is love. And I think, you know, for so many of us, I just feel like that hasn't changed and probably never will change, because I feel like, you know, it's deeply biological. We are all animals underneath. For so many of us, we want to reproduce and partner up and all those kind of things. And there's a lot that we will sacrifice for love. And, you know, my heart breaks when I read of so many of these creative women, you know, their stories. I've put them in Dissolve. One of them that I found was so fascinating because I felt her journey was different. She was so empowered as a writer, kind of falling in with the male writer, and that was Janet Frame. Frank Sargent, he was amazing. He basically said to her, go write. You need to carve out that space and that time for yourself to be yourself. He was gay. She wasn't in a sexual relationship with him. The dynamic was totally different. But for so many of these women, it was like they were reduced to, you know, the muse. You know, I think muse is such an ugly, complicated term for a female. You know, they were there to be slept with and to do the dishes and all that kind of thing, to provide the distraction from the creativity. And for me, I feel that if I had ended up with a writer, any writer, I probably wouldn't have written myself within the right relationship to the extent that I do now. I was dissolved in my relationship with a writer. He was a good man and all the rest of it. It was something that I did to myself, and I think it all gets down to confidence and self-esteem and what you think yourself is a woman's role in these situations. So very complicated.
I thought it was really interesting how you were able to sort of crystallise the fact that, I guess, the core of the issue, obviously self-doubt is a huge thing, but also the fact that if you could have this idea of love, you were willing to sacrifice what you now realise is like your oxygen. You know, you need your writing.
Exactly.
And we do that. Women do. We do that over and over again.
That's beautifully put, because that's exactly the feeling that it is. And I think it befalls so many young women, and it's only as we get older. You know, I didn't really recognise that until maybe my mid-30s or onwards. And, you know, for years it was like, what was I thinking? And now it's just like, it's, you know, I'm in my mid-50s now, and I just think it's what we do. I wrote Dissolve as a warning for young women, as kind of a hope that they will somehow preserve their confidence and their sense of self, and they won't have it nibbled away and eroded. But I think it's something deep and innate within women that, you know, this lack of confidence and this self-doubt can be overwhelming and completely veer us from the path of authenticity.
Yes, and it's almost like there's all these complicit parts in our society that make that possible too. So I liked how you were reflecting on the notion of the genius, and so often, you know, the male genius has been used in a way to excuse really terrible behaviour, to sort of set up a framework that everyone else is expected to fit into.
Exactly, exactly. And I think, you know, a harsh light is being cast upon the word genius at the moment, because we do assume that that's male. We very rarely talk about a female genius, and it excuses so much bad behavior. But I think, you know, one of the worst things that male genius does is it crushes female authenticity, our own creativity, and hopefully that is changing. But I still don't see a lot of women, you know, spoken of as geniuses. You know, it's just an interesting gendered thing, a heartbreaking gendered thing. But it's good that we're having these conversations and that the younger generation is absolutely aware of it. And, you know, I look at young women now, teenagers now, and I think you guys see straight through it. And it's great, you know, because I didn't when I was younger. It took me many, many years, decades, to work out the system. And just for years I felt, I don't get it. Why am I being put into this box? Why do I feel like the person, the woman I'm meant to be is not me, is not the person I want to be? Why am I told to lower my voice and to stop questioning and to stop asking the difficult questions? Why am I conditioned to always say yes when I might be screaming inside to say no, no, this isn't fair? You know, I spent so many years as a young woman just kind of raging against what felt deeply unfair. And I think the difference now is that young women absolutely perceive that unfairness and can talk about it and can call it out. And I think that's the big change, and that's a great change. I'm just sitting back looking at them and going, bring it on. You know, Edith Wharton was talking about it 100 years ago. 120 years ago, she wrote about the curtain of niceness that falls over young women. And I still feel like even now, young women have a curtain of niceness that falls across them as they enter puberty and go through their teenage years. You know, studies show that they have a big drop in confidence. And I see these young girls around me who are like 7 or 8 and they're sparky and they're stubborn and they're strong in the world. Piles in on them, and you know, as they go through their teenage years, they're taught to be quieter, to be nice, to be meek, to, you know, do collect the dishes and do the washing up at the end of the evening and all that kind of thing. Ambition is a dirty word for us, you know. Saying you have self-belief is a dirty word, is kind of seen as something really disparaging. And I can remember, you know, men as well as women, when I was younger, they used to say, oh, you're driven, like it's a really bad thing. Mm. And it's like women aren't going to get ahead unless they have self-drive, unless they have grit and guts and discipline, unless they have drive, which in a man is seen as something heroic and muscular. In a woman, it's seen as unseemly. You know, people said to me I had self-belief when I was younger. Oh, my God, if only they knew. If only they knew that crumbling little ball of insecurity that, you know, I was inside, drowning in imposter syndrome, thinking I'm not good enough, I don't deserve this. I've only really recently shaken that all off, only in the past couple of years. It's taken a long time. And I think for some women, it can be absolutely crushing, those headwinds that are coming at them.
You know, I was thinking that writing this book, maybe I'm wrong, but I would imagine it would be very cathartic, because you've really examined, you know, you've looked under lots of rocks here, and it feels like there is resolve in this book, you know. How do you feel about the concept of self-doubt for yourself and also for women after you've done this sort of amazing examination of it all?
Oh, look, I just feel like we've just got to go, fuck it, can I even swear in your...
Yeah. I don't know.
You know, it's just like, oh, just put it aside and let it go. And you know, I think artists are the risk takers. Mm. Take the risk, plunge, dive, do that thing that you've always wanted to do. And yes, there will be people who tell you, what are you doing? And you know, and you're no good. And I think women are very good at taking that on board. I was for years. I say find your champions. You know, I throughout my creative life, I've always, and my professional life, my working life generally, there have been certain people, and I will say it's always been women, who've been my champions. who've basically said, I believe in you. Mm. And, you know, the media narrative is that, you know, we're awful to each other and we won't support each other. I think nothing is further from the truth. We know what it's like for each other and how hard it is. And we look out for each other. And I think that's great. And we have to keep on doing that, passing the lessons on, which is really what Dissolve is. It's passing the lessons on to younger women to say, you know, you're okay, you're magnificent. You know, those little voices in your head that are saying, I can't do this, I'm not good enough, you know, I'm meant to be just looking after the kids or whatever it is, just go for it. Just give it a go and see how you go, because there will be your champions out there. You will always reach someone, and just aim to reach those people. You know, find the heart lifters in your life rather than the heart sinkers, because as an artist, you will always have the heart sinkers. They're usually the people who've never created anything themselves, or they've tried and they've failed, and they're very good at putting others down, creative people down. But, you know, your champions will be out there, and that's why I say just go for it. And I guess with Dissolve too, I wanted a hopeful message of, you know, I was crushed by this period in my life where I just wanted all that traditional stuff of getting married and settling down. I saw that as a barometer of success. And, you know, I felt like when I was jilted before we got married, you know, the chapel had been booked and people told and all the rest of it, I felt like I was an absolute failure and unlovable. And I just, it was so hard, so humiliating, it was so hard to face the world again. It was like, I failed. I can't even get someone to love me. But I did pick myself up. It took me a good couple of years. And, you know, I entered that very exclusive club called Heartbreak, which no one wants to be a member of. But, oh, my God, you know, everyone who's in that club knows exactly the pain and the hurt that you go through, the evisceration. But I did pick myself up. And basically what I thought was the most traumatic time of my life that absolutely broke my life, in hindsight, was the biggest gift of my life, because I wasn't meant to be with that person, and I never would have written to the extent that I do now if I had stayed with that person. Something in my soul would have been subsumed by him, by my voracious love for him, and by his creative energy, which was so dominating, perhaps without him even realizing it. He didn't even think that it was dominating energy at all. He was him, and he just did what he did without realizing that I was drowning in the background, and I wasn't producing anything. I wasn't writing at all during that time, except for what I wrote in my journals. So it was a gift that he said, I can't do it. I can't go through with this relationship. But I didn't see that for many, many years. And then I, you know, I looked back at like Sylvia with Ted and Camille Claudel with, you know, Rodin, and Dora Maar with Picasso. And I thought, wow, what would they have been without those men and those enveloping, swamping, enormous relationships, those life-defining relationships? How did it change them and destroy them in some instances? And I probably would have been destroyed in the process of being with this man. And he's a good man, and his heart is in the right place. I was changing myself by being his partner. I've never been like that again. I've found a much quieter, more nourishing and truer love now.
I really feel like this work will resonate with a lot of women.
Yes. And do you think beyond creative women? Because I feel like it's not just, it's about how all women navigate their way through through the world. It's you know, how we are in job interviews and why we don't ask for pay rises. And, you know, in so many areas, this sense of insecurity or lack of confidence that bleeds through so much of what we do. It's hard, you know.
Yeah. It has been fabulous talking to you, Nikki Gemmell, and I wish you every success with Dissolve and The Ripping Tree, and look forward to anything else that you're going to bring us in, you know, across the rest of your career. Thank you.
Look, thank you. What a joy it has been talking to you, madam. We are kin, so thank you for that. Loved it.
thank you. That's great.
You've been listening to Art Vox, Rebecca Wilson talking to best-selling author Nikki Gemmell. You can find out more about Nikki's work through her website online and her Instagram page. And the jingle at the beginning and end of this podcast is courtesy of freesound.org, and the music is by Nigel Nix, Mouth Music. Until next time, thanks for listening. Bye for now.